MenaWatch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think Tank.
Welcome to a new episode of Mena Talk. My name is Yasmin Aremi. I'm a journalist at MenaWatch, and my guest today is Avner Avraham, a former Israeli intelligence officer and founder of the Intelligence Heritage Center's museum in Israel. Nice to have you here. Welcome, Avner.
Hello, Yasmin.
Could you briefly introduce yourself to our audience and tell a bit about your past?
So I'm a former Mossad officer, and I retired when I turned to 50 years old. I'm 61 years old today, and I retired 11 years ago. And I started with the Mossad as a young soldier when I was 19 years old. I worked with them in Lebanon. And after I finished my military service, during my military service, I became officer also. And only 2 days after I finished my military service, I was 22 years old. I started working with the Mossad, and I worked for 28 years, more than 50 different countries around the world, more than 10 years, which was amazing. And I'm here to share with you some stories.
Looking back, what did you learn in your early years in service that stayed with you now, like, the most and strongly?
So before you reach the Mossad, you don't know anything about the spy. I'm sure that you saw James Bond films and you think that you're going to have a Jaguar and a nice suit, and you become a pilot and travel all over the world and party all the time. But the real life are very gray. It's very hard, sometimes dangerous, but it's something important to defend your country. So it's like a military service, actually.
You have a background in Iraq and is rooted in the story of Operation Ezra or Nimia. How has the heritage shaped your sense of identity and history also in the intelligence service?
So it's a good question, because the fact that the Mossad is one of the best spy agency in the world is the reason that we came from different places. As you mentioned, my family came from Iraq, Iraqian Jew. So we look Iraqian, dark skin, we speak Arabic at home, and the languages in Mossad are like weapons. If you speak different languages, it's one of the most important thing. And also, your appearance. Think about 10 Japanese or 10 Chinese coming to operation in South America. They all look the same. People immediately find the difference. But if I travel in South America, I look like maybe someone from Spain, from Italy. And in the story of the Jewish people is the fact that we came from all over the world. So that's why we can hide ourselves in a better way. We have blue eyes, we have black eyes, we have brown eyes, we have blonde, we have dark, we have even Ethiopian Jews, okay? So if we have operation in Africa, we can send Ethiopian agent, you see?
Normally the public have like a big misconception about the Mossad. What would you say is like the biggest misconception you heard about?
There is no... I mean, it's not fun to fly all the time and to be 3 days in Paris and then 4 nights in London. I mean, it's not vacation, and it's not something that you really, it's a very hard work. It's very hard work. So at the end of the day, from outside, it looks like, wow, you have a wonderful job. You live in a 5-star hotels, but there's a lot of pressure. Sometimes it's dangerous. You all the time need to keep secrets. You need to use a different name sometimes. You look different. You cannot call your family. You cannot call directly to your country because you're not allowed to do it. So it's very hard. it's very gray life.
And you are really a long time away from your family and relatives, I guess, as well.
You know, the joke in the Mossad is that you enter to the Mossad single and you retired divorced. And it also happened to me because you have small kids and you're far away from home and your wife, she's taking care about the kids, but you are far away and you cannot help her. So this is the results.
Besides of your work at Mossad, you became involved in founding a museum and curating the Museum of Intelligence and Special Functions, which is also, I guess, super exciting. Why was it important to you to bring intelligence history into a public and into an educational setting?
So actually, I'm not a historian, but I'm a collector. And I collect crazy things. I remember myself buying things also in the flea market in Frankfurt along the river from time to time when I came to Germany. So I'm a collector. And when I came to the Mossad, I found out that there is a lot of original objects that the agents use in different operations and no one keep them. We keep the documents, okay? We must keep the documents. But there is no any rule that you have to save original objects like guns, communication systems, fake passports. So I started to build a big collection. And after years, I established the first spy museum in Israel, the Mossad Museum. I also became a professional curator and I learned in Tel Aviv University. And today, after I retired, one of my companies that I own is a special company that produce medals. This is, by the way, a medal. It's not a circle, as you see. It's not a coin. It's a special medal. Looks like a pager, and it's, of course, from the Green Beeper operation that I'm sure you heard about it. So I think that we can also learn from, it's not only the heritage and the history, you can learn a lot of how to think outside the box, how to be creative, how to think difference, how to think opposite, and it can also help you in your life or in your business. If you have the skills of spy, you can use them also in the everyday life. You know what? Also for dating. After I divorced, I needed to make some connections in the bar. So sometimes I used a spy skills.
When you turn secret operations into exhibitions in the museum, how did you decide what can be shown, what must remain classified, untold? I guess it's super exciting because we can't even imagine.
So usually 80% of the story all the Mossad employee can see, but sometimes the rest of the 20% you cannot show it to everyone because the museum in the Mossad is in a public area, so everybody can see it. Some of my exhibition, for example, Operation Finale, the capture of Eichmann, I came twice to Germany, to Munich. In Munich, we showed the exhibit for almost 8 months in the Egyptian Art History Museum. It was a huge exhibition. We translated everything to German and we brought original objects from the operation. For example, the real Leica camera that we use to take pictures of Eichmann before the capture. And there's also another exhibition that I made about Operation Entebbe, the hijack plane 50 years ago to Uganda. And it was one of the most famous and successful commando operation ever, that Israel released the hostages in Entebbe. So I also made this exhibition, and I made a big exhibition outside the Mossad. And of course, you cannot show everything. When you take the exhibit outside, you have to decide if there is things that you cannot show. You need the permission. But as I told you, 80% you can show, and it's enough.
As you said and mentioned, you created exhibitions about Adolf Eichmann and Operation Entebbe. Why do these two operations still resonate strongly today?
So Operation Finale, the capture of Eichmann, the name of the exhibit in Germany was How to Catch a Nazi. It's important because The Eichmann trial was and still very, very important. It was a turning point in Israel when Holocaust survivors start talking about the Holocaust. It was the first time that we wrote the book of the Holocaust. We spoke about it. We brought witnesses, and the trial, we couldn't do the trial without capturing Eichmann. So that's why the operation was so important. And in my exhibition, you can see the capture and you can see also the trial. So that's why it's so important. And about Entebbe, it's really releasing innocent people that became hostages. 256, by the way. And after the terrorists released the non-Israeli passengers, we still needed to rescue and release 105 hostages. And it was a big success because we lost, unfortunately, Yoni Netanyahu, the commander of the elite unit. And we also lost four hostages. Three of them in the terminal when we released the hostages, and the last one in she was in a hospital, and the crazy Idi Amin, the president of Uganda, sent people to kill her after 2 days. But if you look about operation 4,000 kilometers from Israel, and you are coming with six planes and 220 soldiers, and you come back safe, and you bring everybody, and you lose only four, or actually three hostages and one commander, it's a success. It's a military success. And I know that people around the world in the military bases and armies learn about it, how to plan a commando operation. It's very, very complicated, the operation. And so I made exhibition, and I'm also lecturing about it.
Do you think, when we are talking about the success of operations, that the public can ever fully understand the decision-making behind operations? Sometimes they are judged in like real time, and you are all under extreme pressure. How is your experience with that?
Sometimes, if I understood the question, sometimes when you plan the operation under pressure, you have only a few days, and it shows that you can make a great operation without planning too much. Sometimes you can do something very fast. The fact that you have only 2 or 3 days and you have deadline, and you can learn from operations, even after 50 years, you can learn about how to think outside the box and how to give a chance to any sometimes stupid or too creative idea. And if you know the past, you can learn from the past. I can give you like an example. Let me show you here in my collection. I have a radio. Okay, you see this radio, by the way, if you don't have energy or battery, you can load it with this manual. Now, in this radio, this is a stupid radio, simple radio. You can listen to a radio stations. Okay, so let's say that there is in Germany a radio station that play every 1 hour the news and play music, okay? German music all the day. The Mossad used the Israeli radio stations to transfer messages to agents by playing a particular song. So, for example, we told one of our agents that was in Iraq. It's even today, it's an enemy country to Israel. We told him that on August 14, 1966, you have to turn on your radio at 7 a.m. and we are going to play a song in Arabic. And the meaning of this, the name of the song is Welcome, Welcome. It means, if you hear this song, you have a green light to take off with your MiG-21 Russian jet and fly directly from Iraq, just escape from Iraq, fly directly to Israel safely, and you can land in our Israeli military base, Israeli Air Force base. Okay. So this is a way that it's a one-way connection or communication that you broadcast a song and the agent can listen to the radio. No one can locate him. Okay. You don't know that he sit at home and listen to the radio. And it's very normal to listen to music. And this is the way that we also use in after the Holocaust, when we smuggle Holocaust survivors to Israel in an illegal way with the ships, we didn't have communication systems, so we used also to play songs. And we got six songs with different meaning. And the captain knew that if he can hear this song, it means escape. And this song, it means go to the north. And the other song is go to the south. So you can navigate with the songs. Okay? You like the idea?
That's impressive. That's very impressive.
And today I'm also consulting spy films in Hollywood. So I'm using this when I'm teaching the actors or I'm working with the directors. I can teach them how to do it right because I know the history. So you can use the history even for, operations, in this modern life.
So you advise on spy films, including also Operation Final. When we talk about filmmakers, what do they get right about intelligence work and what do they usually get wrong?
So usually we start with the script. So when I'm consulting films, there is someone else that wrote the script and sometimes there is mistakes and cliches and it's too late to change the script. So usually what I'm doing is I'm changing the things that the camera see. Okay? Even if you don't change the text, you change what the camera see. For example, it's all about small details. If you have 10 agents that flying from different places coming to Argentina to capture Eichmann, it doesn't make sense that they will come together and they will be together, they will sit together, and they will come with Air France from Paris to Buenos Aires. So you need to show, I saw that they are going to use a tags for suitcases, all of them a vintage tag from the 50s that belonged to Air France. And I told the director, we should use different airlines. Let's say Lufthansa, Sabena, and other companies. I got the right list of the companies that they use in the real operation, because in my exhibition, I got the original tickets. So that's why I could know the name of the companies. And, we shot the scene again with the right stickers to show us that they came from different places and why they came from different places, because they came with the fake passports from different countries. that match the languages that they can speak. So if someone grew up in Austria, he came with a German passport because he can speak German, but he flew to Paris by himself. And someone that grew up in Romania, he flew to London, and from London he came to by himself to Argentina. So this is the things that I'm changing in films, and it works very well. And I'm also, don't forget, I'm playing cameo in each film. You can find me in one or two scenes.
Which film?
For example, Operation Finale. You can find me there. Watch again the film and you can find me. There is a scene in a cafe. I'm playing with Oscar Isaac. We are playing cards in a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Watch the film in Netflix.
Spy stories remain actually powerful in the pop culture, in the popular culture. You told us the real work is more a little bit of the hard way, a little bit slow, exhausting as well. Do you think like the movie industry is displaying it well and understanding the real work of intelligence service?
No, I think that even today, directors and producers and screenwriters doing the same mistakes because they grew up and saw James Bond. James Bond is not the real life. It's the opposite. Because if agent can speak languages, he will not show it. And James Bond shows that he can understand Russian, for example. We don't use fancy cars. Okay. We use a local gray popular car. We don't use a red shining Jaguar. Okay. We don't wear a suit with bow tie. Okay. We buy a regular clothes in the same country. So sometimes you need to teach. You need to change. Sometimes it's too late, but you need to show. And this is the very special things that I'm doing with producers all over the world.
Oh, of course, the intelligence service is not flashy and fashion so that everyone can find the people. It's more in the underground, staying like the public image that makes sense. When films and exhibitions influenced the society and the understanding of Israel's security history, is it like that you think the movies are displaying Israel's intelligence security service better than official institutions or the media?
First of all, I think that we have a problem with the media because we don't explain ourselves. You can see the war that started, the massacre from October 7, that suddenly people from Gaza attack Israel and killed 1,200 people in the same day, raped women and took 250 and more than 250 hostages. We have a very big problem with explaining this because in most places in the TV, they don't see the real narrative. But in the films, it's depend if it's a television series like Fauda that we are doing in Israel, it's very accurate and very close to the real story because the people behind this television series came from the same unit. Okay, they served in the same unit, so it's almost a doco. Now, as I told you about spy films around the world, there was a lot of mistakes. Sometimes they have people that consult them. Sometimes they take a book that a former CIA wrote, so it's easier for them. But there is a big gap between the true story and the real story in the spy stories and also in the news.
But when we look a little bit into the past, when the people talk about security, intelligence, and the use of force, What lessons from the Mossad operations remain relevant in the real life and also in other militaries?
I think that we found out that in during the years, most of the time, we didn't take any responsibility for operations. We just, I can tell you, after the massacre on 1972 in Munich, in the Olympic Games, when we lost 11 of our members, 11 of the Israeli delegation, 11 members, and the Prime Minister Golda Meir decided that the Mossad will find the people that were responsible and kill them. And the Mossad made several operations and came, for example, to Paris and found the terrorist, killed him, and disappeared. And we didn't take any responsibility. But today, I think that we find out that if you take responsibility, your enemy can be more afraid from you. They know your ability. And in most of the time, they know that only the Israelis can do this kind of operation. I mean, to find someone that stays in a room, in a hotel, in this room, and this side of the room, and to find and kill only him because he is a terrorist that buying weapons to use against us, against our families, against our country. So suddenly you wake up in the morning and you heard that he's gone. And no one takes responsibility. But today we take the responsibility. And the Grimm people, for example, if you check in YouTube, you can find interviews with Mossad agents that took part in the Grimm people operation. So this is the new policy that we take responsibility and we also talk about it.
So that other militaries also learn about your kind of work, especially for counterterrorism.
We also cooperate with different, of course, with the Austrian, with the German. We cooperate with military and with intelligence, and we help each other.
Would you say that they are listening enough to the Mossad?
Well, I think for them it's like a music. They listen to the music because they learn. They always want to learn and to take ideas because if you come with the right ideas, you can save life.
We talked about journalists sometimes, and the media is mixing up a little bit the stories and not telling like the whole picture. What should journalists and also historians be especially careful about when covering about intelligence affairs? What would you advise?
Think about what happened on October 7th with the massacre. The terrorist, the Hamas terrorist, entered to Israel with a GoPro camera. Okay, each one of them came with a GoPro camera, and he just made the videos of all the awful things that he done. Okay, so think about that. We have most of the video files, but we cannot. I mean, we use it to show it to the world. But still, even if you come with the true story, they don't believe you or they don't want to believe you because sometimes there is an anti-Semitism journalist. They just want to talk against Israel. Okay. So, they are not, they don't want to tell the true story or the real news. They have agenda. So they will always, like Al Jazeera. The Al Jazeera is always against Israel. Everything that they do, they try to interview me and I refuse because I told them everything you do is against my country. Okay. It's not a real news. Real news that you come with the real news. You don't hide things and you don't give fake news. That's the problem. And we saw that, in some places, there is Arab countries that pay a lot of money and for people to talk against us. You can see demonstrations that are sponsored by Arab countries like Qatar.
Yes, we're covering up at MENA Watch often about stuff like this. There are also countless fake news nowadays, stories and fake social media accounts as well, also impersonating the Mossad. There are stories about trained Mossad dolphins and other animals. In all of this propaganda and disinformation about Israel and the Mossad, how do you think fake news distorts people's understanding of the real intelligence work and Israel?
First of all, I can tell you it's not a secret that intelligence services use animals for spying and also for a military. I can tell you that the Russians use, against the Germans, they use dogs with bombs. They teach them that they got the food. If they go under the tank, when they hear the noise of the tank and they can smell the gasoline, and they used to send them with a bomb to suicide. The CIA took a cat and put inside his body a microphone, transmitter, and antenna. And the idea was to send this cat to the Russian headquarter embassy, the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C., and the cat goes inside and he can go between the diplomat, the Russian diplomats, and he can receive conversations and transmit it back to the CIA. So, and also about dolphins, it's true. There is a true story to use the dolphins. You can teach them to do things. And I'm not going to share all the secrets, but you can find in the Google a lot of things that you can do with animals. So it's not really a fake news.
We keep it like that. Don't go into the details. So you do a lot of work. You bring a lot of life experience with you. What do you hope visitors, readers, also from the museum and also your homepage, take away after encountering your work?
I think that they can learn, first of all, they can learn the Israeli history, the Mossad history, and they can also be inspired. They can be better. They can think in a creative way. Sometimes, if you know like 200 different creative stories, it can help you also to solve problems. And I can give you a small example that I use in my everyday life. When I go to buy vegetables and fruit, at the beginning, I used to go with a list of things that I need to buy. And it took me 1 hour. I needed to spend 1 hour to find everything and to buy it. And then I found out that it's better to come with the list of the things that I already have at home. Let's say that I have too much for potatoes and I have tomatoes also. So I'm just buying everything that I need except the things that I already have. So it took me 15 minutes. Okay? Just think in the opposite way. And I can tell you that in Sudan, when we smuggled Ethiopian Jews with a fake passport, we didn't have the same pen that the Sudanian use to write names inside the passports. Now, instead of trying to find how to get the same pen that they use, we bought 200 Parker's pens and we sent them with a different secret service in Germany, in Africa. And the secret agent came and told them, this is the best pens that you need to use now to your passports. And they start using our pens. Okay. So in this way, you have the same pen, but actually you are the one that supply them your pens. Okay, so this is an example how to think different.
Thank a lot for your insights into the world of intelligence. If you are interested to buying the Grim Beeper, you can find it on Avner's homepage. We are going to link it. There is also information about the movies he's working on and his work in general. Thank you for listening to this episode of Mina Talk. My name is Yasmina Rimi. And if you found this conversation useful, don't forget to subscribe on our channel, activate the bell and follow us on social media. Until next time. Bye.
Thank you, Yasmin.
Mina Watch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank. Besuchen Sie auch unsere Website. Dort finden Sie täglich neue aktuelle Berichte und ausführliche wissenschaftlich fundierte Hintergrundanalysen zur Geschichte und Gegenwart der MENA-Region.
Eine Produktion von MENA Watch, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.